It's wonderful to see all your faces. So each year we have a chance to read Parshat Yitro, the Torah reading that describes the revelation of Yod-Heh-Vav-Heh to Moses and the Israelites at Mount Sinai. And we're always reminded that revelation can be bewildering, unsettling, overwhelming, and possibly traumatic to experience directly. The experience can't be captured in words. So Jewish practice encourages us to receive the teaching indirectly through the narrative we read, and particularly through the story that we reenact each Passover at the Seder. We're often reminded that Torah was given and Yod-Heh-Vav-Heh was revealed to those who, as Moses reminds us later in Torah in the book of Deuteronomy, Devarim, that Yod-Heh-Vav-Heh was revealed to everyone who was there that day and everyone who was not there, future generations, anyone not able to be present because of physical or emotional needs, and I imagine some people were taking care of their children as well. But for those of us not there that day, the narrative of Torah stories, the chanting of liturgy, the enactment of rituals, and of course, our sitting together in silence each week, grounded in Torah study and chant, continuously recreate conditions for ongoing revelation. Our sitting practice and our recent exploration of the nature of mind last week prepare us to appreciate the ongoing revelation that is more subtle and less traumatic than the awesome experience at Sinai. Our practice prepares us for the revelation that's constantly emerging and re-emerging from the meeting of this mind-body flow of energy with all of reality unfolding in each moment. We rest in awareness, reality unfolds, and from time to time, a revelation arises in daily life, not particularly during meditation, a moment of experiencing the exquisite presence of something very ordinary that we might pass by and ignore every day, a moment of feeling totally present, lost in our participation with the flow of life, without being separated from it by judgments. These and other moments, which perhaps we can talk about in our discussion, are the day-to-day revelations that we may or may not recognize, but that ultimately transform our relationship with life and death. So, if revelation is available in every moment, why aren't we noticing it all the time? As I thought about how could I answer this question, I recalled an answer given in one of my favorite Dharma teachings in a book by Pema Chodron called Start Where You Are. Some of you may know it. And it's from the chapter called Three Objects, Three Poisons, Three Seeds of Virtue. Pema explains that all the messy stuff in our lives, particularly the three poisons of addictive craving, aversion or aggression and ignorance. This messy stuff is called klesha in Pali or Sanskrit, which means poison. It's a mental state that clouds the mind, prevents clear seeing, and leads to unhealthy action. Now, I always chuckle when I hear the word kleshas as obstacles to awakening because the word reminds me of the Hebrew word Klipa or klipot, and the plural for the klipot is the plural for klipa. And these are described as the shells created, the husks created by an individual's negative actions that create a metaphysical barrier between oneself and the light. They temporarily block divine light from reaching a person. A layer, a veil that needs to be peeled off to open the person to divine light. And like the klesha in Buddhist teaching, the klipa, the obstacle, can also be the gateway for awakening, as Pema explains. So I will quote her own words in this next paragraph. The pith of all Buddhist teaching is whatever you do, don't try to make these unwanted feelings go away. That's an unusual thought. It's not our habitual tendency to let these feelings hang around. Our habitual tendency is definitely to try to make those things go away. People and situations in our lives are always triggering our passion, aggression, and ignorance. A good old innocent cup of coffee triggers some people's craving. They're addicted to it. It represents comfort and all the good things in life. If they can't get it, their life is a wreck. Other people have this elaborate storyline about why it's bad for you, and they have aversion and a support group. Plenty of other people couldn't care less about a cup of coffee. It doesn't mean much to them at all. And then there's good old Mortimer. Some people are lusting when they see Mortimer. A good deal of their discursive thought is taken up about what they'd like to do with Mortimer. A certain number of people hate him. They haven't even talked to him yet, but the minute they saw him, they felt loathing. Some of us haven't even noticed him. We may never notice him. In fact, a few years from now, he'll tell us he was here and we'll be surprised. Our experience would write the formula as three objects, three poisons, and lots of misery. Three objects, three poisons, and three seeds of confusion, bewilderment, pain. Because the more the poisons arise and the bigger they get in our life, the more they drive us crazy. They keep us seeing from the world as it is. The world doesn't speak for itself because we're so caught up in our storyline that instead of feeling that there's a lot of space in which we could lead our life as a child of illusion, we're robbing ourselves from letting the world speak for itself. You just keep speaking to yourself and nothing speaks to you. The poisons are always trapping you in one way or another, imprisoning you and making your world really small. When you feel craving, you could be sitting on the edge of the Grand Canyon, but all you see is this piece of chocolate cake you're craving. With aversion, you're sitting on the edge of the Grand Canyon, and all you can hear is the angry words you said to someone 10 years ago. With ignorance, you're sitting on the edge of the Grand Canyon with a paper bag over your head. Each of the three poisons has the power to capture you so completely that you don't even perceive what's in front of you. So, those are Pema's words. I once shared this teaching with a colleague who is very much valued by others for his impressive fund of knowledge and critical thinking. Thinking myself that these metaphors, especially the paper bag over your head at the Grand Canyon, could speak for themselves, I said, so that's why we lose out when we're preoccupied with these things. And my colleague conceded, well, yeah, but that's if you're sitting on the edge of the Grand Canyon. And in that moment, I understood we are always sitting on the edge of the Grand Canyon, just like we are always standing at Sinai, just as we are in this very moment. And I recall another quote from Pema Chodron, whatever is happening is the path to enlightenment. So, how does each poison become a seed of virtue? Pema explains that with regular practice, it becomes easier to recognize the anger, the aversion as it arises. At first, We recognize it only after we've done damage, hurt someone's feelings, been mean, and then we recognize it as we catch ourselves in the act, and we may be able to stop ourselves before we do more damage. And eventually, we recognize what is happening right before we act with aggression. And eventually, we can recognize at the very beginning the revving up of our thoughts, the blaming mind going into action. And then, with this early warning system, we can say, oh, anger has arisen, and this can sometimes interrupt the momentum. When we recognize this anger, we are instructed, particularly in the Lojong slogans of Tibetan Buddhism, to recognize how many beings share this painful state of aversion with us. So it's an opportunity to feel compassion for ourselves and others tormented by this painful mental state. And Pema advises that we make our fellow sufferers the beneficiaries of our insight. Letting the aspiration arise, may they be endowed with the root of virtue of freedom for anger. We make virtuous use of our angry impulses by recognizing how many fellow humans suffer with this painful state that distorts our connection with others, and by turning our minds and hearts to sincerely wishing that they could be relieved of that anger for their own sake, not just for our sake, so they'll stop driving us crazy. And the same can be said of craving. As Pema says, expand your awareness right on the spot and let the aspiration arise. May the countless sentient beings be endowed with the root of virtue that is freedom from attachment. May they be free from this craving that I am now experiencing. Now, one of the Tibetan teachers, Jamgon Khantro, I'm not sure how to pronounce that, taught a technique that goes even farther in advising that we practice taking on the suffering of others, taking it into ourselves, and using our meditation practice to hold it without acting on it. A capacity to do this is developed through the practice of Tonglen, which some of you may have heard of. And interestingly, it's the opposite of the kind of breathing practice that is often taught by people who focus on meditation as a way to feel better. When we meditate to feel better, we're often taught to breathe out all the tension and difficult emotion and to breathe in that bright, fresh energy. And in contrast, in Tonglen practice, one first prepares by dedicated regular practice and then by sitting silently for a while, and then one imagines taking in the suffering of others, breathing it in, acting almost like an air purifier for the kleshas. For craving, aversion, and ignorance in the world, taking it in, detoxifying it, and sending out warm, loving energy. It is a practice, it's taught that our practice can prepare us to take in all this suffering without being afraid of what it will do to us. Now, I wish I had had the time to explore further exactly how one can, with equanimity, take in all the suffering. But I can imagine a possible answer that a truly expansive awareness could experience this suffering, like the great blue sky contains clouds and thunderstorms, that none of these phenomena damage the sky itself. Or by metaphor, our awareness itself. But I would certainly have to learn more about that before presuming to be able to teach it. Now, our first thought about this practice is probably that it's unimaginable, completely counterintuitive in a world in which the development of our species and our whole personal development is focused on protecting ourselves and our loved ones from pain and suffering. And self-protection is indeed a healthy and natural instinct. Of course, we want to protect this precious gift of human life. And yet, we also get caught up in needing to preserve not only the gift of life and well-being, but our sense of this self, who I am, as a separate, solid thing. Now, getting back to Torah, the fear and danger of losing this sense of a separate self is vividly referred to in our Torah reading. In fact, being present for the revelation is so overwhelming and bewildering that certainly as a reader, I can't even understand the account if I try to read it from a usual perspective of rational, logical thinking. There seem to be several different stories of going up and down the mountain, not adequately woven together. As Everett Fox explains in his commentary, this could be a deliberate thing, stemming from a desire to either include every tradition about this key event that was available to the editors, or else it could be intentional to suggest that such things are impossible to describe in normal language and logical sequence. And this is what Buber suggested in a different context in his reflection on the stammering account, as he referred to it, of Genesis. What remains confusing to me, no matter how many times I have read and reread this parsha, is the approach and avoid dance of the people, of God's role, and of Moses' role in the people needing to keep their distance from Yod-Heh-Vav-Heh. There are several different versions. God forbids the people a few times to come close, lest they die. Yod-Heh-Vav-Heh instructs Moses to come up to the mountain with just Aaron, not anyone else, lest they perish. So Moses receives and delivers what is revealed. And what is revealed? Yod-Heh-Vav-Heh's revelation emerges through what is often called the Ten Commandments, or the Devarim, the ten sayings that start with the familiar words, I am Yod-Heh-Vav-Heh, your God, who brought you out from the land of Egypt. In other words, I am the force that liberated you from a place of narrowness and imprisonment. I'm that liberation energy. And you are forbidden to ever worship anything that represents a tiny fragment of life, any carved image or figure. You can't worship anything that represents a part rather than the whole interconnectedness of everything, every aspect of reality unfolding. And the Sabbath is the day to be just with this amazing creation as it is, and not to work on it. The commandments that follow are guidelines that would naturally arise out of awareness of our interconnectedness, not killing or stealing or bearing false witness or violating the trust of others. And the people agree to this contract, this brit, that in exchange for Yod-Heh-Vav-Heh's special care for them, they will follow all the commandments. And immediately after the commandments are revealed, we read that the people, witnessing the thunder and lightning, the blare of horn and mountain smoking, they fell back and said to Moses, you speak to us, they said to Moses, and we will obey, but let not God speak to us, lest we die. And Moses answers, be not afraid, for God has come only in order to test you, and in order that the fear of God may be ever with you, so that you do not go astray. So the people remained at a distance while Moses approached the thick cloud where God was. And then Moses receives instructions for building an altar. So this is completely confusing, because now Moses says, fear not, but it is a test. I'm not sure what all this means. And then after receiving the commandments, goes into a thick cloud again. So to me, it's not clear whether the people are afraid because of their own recognition that they would literally perish, or metaphorically, maybe having a sense of separate, solid self, maybe that sense will be lost, or whether they're simply heeding Yud-Heh-Vav-Heh's warning to stand back. So we're left with the sense that revelation is an experience that can't be captured in words or images, or certainly not in little carved figurines, as we're told in the commandments. But as in every spiritual tradition, it is very clear that moral and compassionate action naturally rise from a realization of our interconnection. Whatever ineffable sense we might have of Yud-Heh-Vav-Heh, whatever that is, it needs to be expressed through taking care of each other and the world we live in. Respect for all people, of course, and we can add care for all sentient beings, grow out of our expanded awareness, and whether we experience revelation in one way or another or not, these are always, this compassionate action is always the foundation and hopefully the result of spiritual practice.